Welcome to the BFM Historical Society. This week, we talk to DJ Servier, one of the founders of the True School Hip Hop Show. He talks about some of the inspirations that made him want to get up on the radio in the first place, and offers some ideas as to why the True School became such a strong brand. Welcome to the BFM Historical Society, DJ Servier.
Kia ora.
I want to start at the beginning there, Phil. The first time you got involved in BFM and when that was?
As a listener or as a worker?
Well, you can start as a listener.
Well, I think I started listening to B because I was so into music as a child. Like, I was really into music through my father. So I started with all the basics. My initial listening patterns, they consisted of Stevie Wonder. You know, I'm thinking of Dad mowing the lawns on Saturday mornings. It was Stevie Wonder, Aretha Franklin. And then it turned into Bob Marley and Peter Tosh. And then all forms of sort of rock music. And I think because my father was a DJ and I became exposed to so many types of music, I therefore started to develop a taste for everything else. Or just to go deeper. And so I started listening to the radio and I realized that the radio was just the same shit over and over and over again. And it was really boring. I had started to develop a really firm taste for punk music. Someone at my, I think it might have been at school, said, you should listen to this station. And then I spent about 3 weeks trying to figure out where it was because I was living in Papakura out in South Auckland and the signal was really bad. And then one day I found it. It was a Resurrection show. Neil Cartwright, the Resurrection Punk show. I was just a kid listening to music and I went from being a kid listening to music to listening to Mr. Cartwright on the Resurrection show, and it turned me into this beast of a record collector. It was so strong that, you know, he said to me, you need to go out and buy the 7-inch by this band. So I was like, okay, I need to do that, but I can't do it, I've got no money. So I went and got a job on a milk run to make money to go into town on the train to buy records because of him. So it was such a strong feeling that it was, you know, because you know you have passing phases when you're a kid. This one has managed to last me my entire life, and it kind of harked back to that. So I remember way back when he played a Ramones song. So I'm going to play Sheen as a Punk Rocker off the Ramones live album, because at the same time, around the same time, they play the video for this on Radio with Pictures. You add Radio with Pictures and Karen Hay telling me about this song, this video, and I see the moving pictures of it, and you get the Resurrection Punk show playing me the music. This equals the worst record collecting addiction that you can possibly think of, and this is that song, Sheen is a Punk Rocker by the Ramones.
Sheen is a punk rocker. Yeah.
met the Ramones here at this station too. They signed a Planet magazine with their photo on it. I've got it. I got Joey Ramone's dead signature on my... Yeah. I'm going to get it framed. I was a listener of the Resurrection Show for a long time. Neil Cartwright. Because he was really good at saying, I got this from. And so I started to frequent the Record Warehouse, Sounds Unlimited, you name it. I just was all over it in the flash.
And of course, Kerry's Rock and Roll Records.
Rock and Roll Records, and then Real Groovy as well. Kerry was a huge part of my learning curve. Through that and trying to figure out which time of the day I could pick up B the easiest. And then I discovered Murray Kamik as well. From there, Simon Gregg, you name it. It just became, you know, it's pretty easy to figure out my lineage as far as music goes by the people that became important to me, you know.
Yeah,
Neil Cartwright was absolutely one of the first. I used to buy records purely off what he told me to do, because he had the same taste as me. And in turn, my love of urban music and hip-hop and R&B was pretty much fashioned out of what Murray used to feed me. Because back then it wasn't like now, you know. If he had a copy of a record that was the only one in the country, there was actually a record of Murray I hunted off him and got after like 15 years.
It wasn't like there were people all over BFM playing funk. You had to listen to Murray, and then you'd have to wait a week before he did another show, you know.
And that's why his selection became vital. His selection process of sitting at home going, saying, okay, I'm going to play this, this, and this, was crucial, because that's all we had. In turn, later, it became my job to do that. Although, you know, when you do it, when you get on the station, you realize it's just, you just love what you love and you just do what you do. It's not about trying to be selective about, oh, we better play a bit of this and a bit of that. It just happens, yeah.
So I guess at some point, probably when you were still at high school, you kind of thought, oh, maybe I'll do a bit of this DJing.
Yeah, well, I actually got forced into it with a crowbar by my father. So he was DJing at some gig and he needed to go to the bathroom, and he said, you know, you stand there, play that song after that one finishes. And then, you know, he got back and he's like, oh, you actually can do that without making a mess of it. And then I was like, oh, I think we should play this song next because they're gonna like it. And then Dad kind of clicked and went, oh, you're the same age as them, you can do that. So I did it for a little bit longer, and the next gig a bit longer. Dad would just collect the money and get me to do it for free. So it was hilarious. He had a massive record collection. He still does today. His 7-inch collection is pretty considerable. But that's pretty much how it happened. There's a few landmark moments. There was, you know, my sister's birthday party that I DJed at, and everyone was like, oh, you know, that was really cool. And I was starting to think, crumbs, maybe I should do this a bit more. And because don't forget, at the time, my father had a disco unit with two turntables and a mixer in it. Like, I was a little kid, and Dad had already made this, so I was like, oh, I like playing with this. I mean, I was listening to records anyway. Mm. It's not really a surprise, is it? Mm. And then there was like one of the very, very, very first warehouse parties were held on Nelson Street, and I played at that, and then that was it. That was pretty much it. After that, I was done. I was in for life.
I first encountered you guys when Planet were first putting on those parties, Planet and the Galatos crew dudes, and you were Ben, Phil and Nigel, a trio of DJs from South Auckland.
Yeah.
And that was about 89 or 90, so.
Yeah, that was, I think 89 was Planet Rock as well, where we did one at the power station. It was the first 12-hour gig. That was pretty mental when we finished at 10 o'clock the next day, and there was still like 50 people there. Actually, you know, people often ask me, they go, oh, you know, you've done thousands of gigs, and I have. Thinking about it, I've probably done thousands of gigs. What was your favorite gig of all time? One of them was a BFM gig. Yep, it's a BFM gig, and it was early 90s, and it was at where Galatos Street Theatre is now, was across the road. It used to be across the road. And BFM threw this like an orientation party, and it was so amazing. It was three levels, and Asterix was on the top floor selecting. You were probably there.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was on the middle floor, and it was me and Ben and this guy called Les, and I was so on fire, and I never say this because it's so conceited to say that I was on fire, that I locked the door on the DJ box and played for 4 hours. And no one's coming in here. And Liz was like, I'm not going to get paid. And I was like, cool. And he just went home, and I just kept going until the sun came up. And I was like, that was one of my favorite gigs, and it was just the best vibe of all time.
Let's go to the genesis of the True School Hip Hop Show.
As far as I'm aware, it was Slave's idea. It was Rhythm Slave from, you know, MC OJ, Rhythm Slave, Mark Williams, now of Fat Freddy's Drop. It was Daryl's idea, but it was Slave that made it happen because he was the moderate white guy. And me and Daryl were these outspoken, abrasive Māori followers. The precursor to the True School is not so good. Stinky Grooves was doing a show, and then what happened was Stinky would sometimes go away. And then he would hand the show over quite often to Captain Kirk, quite often, and various other people. And then one time, in a very rash decision, he handed it over to me and Daryl. And, you know, we took over Stinky Grooves one night. This is when the studio is, like, on the other side of the building. And you could kind of lock the doors. So we get in there, and me and Daryl are in this ridiculously stupid mood. And then we start just being idiots on air. I can't remember what we did. Like, really, really clearly. But I remember being quite embarrassed about my actions about a month later, thinking, what was I thinking? You know, like, just self-indulgent, stupid kids, you know? And our most infamous moment was, this is predating the True School Hip Hop Show, is we played Straight Outta Compton by NWA. And because it was full of really foul language, Daryl and I turned the mics on, and we beat out the words manually.
Excellent.
Even though we didn't have to, you know, like, there was no reason to do that. We're in the studio, and no one's telling us what to do, and I just want to talk the whole show. So we can actually play the song if you want. We should play the song now. It's one of our songs we're going to play. And you can imagine how annoying it was. Like, the phones were ringing the whole time. So, you know, Straight Outta Compton's playing, and Ice Cube saying, fuck. And every time he said fuck, we go beep with the mics. But this song is full of it. So it was beep, 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 beep. And so we learned, and then we figured out we could lock the door because someone was like banging on the door saying, what are you guys doing? And the phones are going off. I don't think Jim spoke to us for a little while after that. Niggas without a chick. Niggas without a chick. Niggas without a
chick. I'm coming straight out of Compton. When something happens in South Central Los Angeles, nothing happens. It's just another nigga dead, 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 dead. Straight out of Compton, crazy motherfucker named Ice Cube. From the gang called Niggas with Attitudes. When I'm called off, I got a sawed off. Squeeze a trigger and bodies are hauled off. You too, boy, if you fuck with me, the police are gonna have to come and get me. Off your ass, that's how I'm going out. For the punk motherfuckers that's showing out. Niggas want to mumble, they wanna rumble. Mix them and cook them in a pot like gumbo. Going off on the motherfucker like that.
What's up?
Tell them where you from.
Straight out of Compton. Another crazy ass nigga. When punks I smoke, yo, my rep gets bigger. I'm a bad motherfucker and you know this. But the pussy ass niggas won't show this. But I don't give a fuck, I'ma make my snaps. If not from the records, from jacking across, it's like burglary. The definition is jacking. But when illegally armed, it's called packing. Shoot a motherfucker in a minute. I'll find a good piece of pussy and go up in it. So if you're at a show in the front row, I'ma call you a bitch or a dirty ass hoe. You probably get mad like a bitch is supposed to. But that shows me slut junk and pose to a crazy motherfucker from the street. Attitude legit, cause I'm tearing up shit. MC Ren controls are automatic. For any dumb motherfucker, it starts static. Battle right hand, cause I'm a hand itself. Every time I pull an AK off the shelf, the security is maximum, and that's a law. R-E-N spells red, but I'm wrong. See, cause I'm a motherfucking villain. The definition is clear, you're the witness of a killing that's taking place without a clue. And once you're on the scope, your ass is through. Look, you might take it as a trip, but a nigga like Ren is on the gangster tip. Straight out of Compton. Compton. Compton.
Compton.
his name and the boys coming.
Straight out of Compton. It's a brother that'll smother your mother and make your sister think I love her. Dangerous motherfucker raising hell. And if I ever get caught, I make bail. See, I don't give a fuck. That's the problem. I see a motherfucking cop, I don't dodge him. But I'm smart, lay low, free for a while. And when I see the punk pass, I smile. To me, it's kind of funny. The attitude show a nigga driving. But don't know where the fuck he going, just rolling. Looking for the one they call easy. But here's a flash. They never sees me ruthless. Never seen like a shadow in the dark. Except when I'm low. You see a spark attack over a hesitation. And hear the scream of the one who got the lead penetration. Feel a little gust of wind and I'm jetting. Believe a memory, no one will be forgetting. So what about the bitch who got shot? Fucker, you think I give a damn about a bitch? I ain't a sucker. This is an autobiography of the E. And if you ever fuck with me, you get taken by a stupid dope brother who will smother. Word to the motherfucker. Straight out of Compton, 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 Compton.
It was 91 that the show actually took shape. So what we did was, it was Slave and Daryl, a DLT, did 1 week, and then myself and Bass did the other week. So we would do this two-weekly thing on and off where they would do their thing. And it was funny because their show was quite political, you know, and they would play lots of political hip-hop. And I was more into the dumb shit. So I would play a whole bunch of gangster rap and some party tunes, and then a bit of what they played. But ultimately, by accident, we kind of covered all the bases. It kind of worked really well, I think. I don't know if Daryl wanted it that way. You know, I'm not trying to be rude, but Daryl wanted the True School to be this. And I think, in hindsight, he was right. But I was just a bit of a wild card, you know, that didn't really want to listen to anybody, but kind of wanted to listen to Daryl, but kind of didn't. And then ultimately just did whatever I wanted.
Prior to the True School, hip-hop music was played on BFM, and for quite a long time, and a lot of run-of-station DJs would slip hip-hop tunes into their mix. And I know Nick D'Angelo, Simon Lyon, was a huge hip-hop fan. He kind of tried to convert BFM into an urban station for the year that he was the station manager. Of course, not forgetting Simon Gregg, because Beats Per Minute, when it first started out, he would do the first hour would be hip-hop, and the second hour would be club music.
I think, actually, I have to give credit to Simon and to Nick as well, although I never liked him at all. Actually, Nick was really important in our development, you know, because he was playing really upfront tunes and boasting about it a lot. It would just piss me off because me and Ben, this other DJ guy that I had a team with, we kind of wanted to feel like we were the guys. But he had a radio show and he was the voice, and we hated him hard out. We sent in this demo tape of this track that him and I made. We sent it into him and he's like, oh yeah, give me your demos and I'll play them. And he didn't play it, and he didn't play it. And we tune in every week and he didn't play it. And you know, one day I ring up Nick, I'm like, what the fuck, man? You know, you didn't play our demo, bro. And then I was really threatening, and then he played it. So, and it was like that started our love hate. I mean, you know, Simon's an awesome guy, you know, and with age, I'm not the dickhead that I used to be, but I used to really dislike him. He used to piss me off on a regular basis because he had all these awesome records. You know, with Simon and Murray, it was different because they were older than me and they were more mature and were more schooled. So I gave them some form of respect. Mm. Nick, on the other hand, was like kind of just a little bit older than me. So I could kind of feel like I could say, you will actually stick it up your ass. I don't like you. That's the inherent nature of hip-hop, to be competitive. But I was from South Auckland, so if anyone fucked with me, I just got violent with it. You know what I mean? It's just, that is the environment. I live in Papakura, end of the train lines. It was pretty gangs out there, so I was kind of like, I don't think I was overtly aggressive, but I certainly didn't take any shit. And it sort of degenerated into this little, I don't even like you, which is ridiculous because now he's a pretty good friend of mine.
Yeah.
He's stupid. The same syndrome exists today. Like, nothing has changed at all. So he was just in a bad spot, you know. He knew how to push all of our buttons. But in hindsight, I think there's a lot of respect for that. What we'll play now is Public Enemy, Don't Believe the Hype. And the reason I'm playing this is because it's kind of like, I think Public Enemy was the band that Daryl made me like. You know, I was initially, I mean, I remember getting Public Enemy number one on 12 inch at the Markets. Where Real Groovy is now, it used to be a market. And somebody there somehow used to get these imports from America sent over, these 12-inch imports. And I found this 12-inch, and I was the first person to have it. It was freaking me out. Yeah, but I listened to it, and I didn't really get it because the production was bizarre. And then Daryl was already over it because he'd been sent cassettes of it from America. And then the album came out Yo Bum Rush the Show. And, you know, I was like, yeah, this is cool, but it's really hard to listen to. It's really hard to listen to. Very abrasive, extremely political. And Daryl's like, nah, you're going to listen to it, and I'm going to play it to you every single day until you like it. And that worked. So Don't Believe the Hype, it kind of is probably my favorite Public Enemy song. And it's got heaps of meaning, and it just reminds me of all these sessions I spent with DLT.
Caught you looking for the same thing. It's a new thing. Check out this I bring. Uh-oh, the road below the level, cause I'm living low next to the base.
Come on!
Turn up the radio. They're claiming I'm a criminal. But now I wonder how. Some people never know. The enemy could be the Frank Guardian. I'm now a hooligan. I rock the party and clear all the madness. I'm not a racist priest to teach the
cause don't they never had this?
Number one, never wanna run about the gun. I wasn't licensed to have one. The minute they see me, fear me. I'm the epitome, a public enemy. Used, abused, without clues. I refuse to blow a fuse. They even had it on the news.
Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype.
Yes, was the start of my last jam. So here it is again, another death jam. But since I gave you all a little something that I knew you lacked, they still consider me a new jack. All the critics you can hang on my hold the rope, but they hope to the Pope and pray it ain't dope. The follower of Farrakhan, don't tell me that you understand until you hear the man. The book up the new school rap game. Writers treat me like Coltrane, insane. Yes to them, but to me, I'm a different kind. We're brothers of the same mind, unblind, caught in the middle end, not surrendering. I don't rhyme for the sake of riddling. Some claim that I'm a smuggler. Some say I never heard of ya, a rap burglar. False media, we don't need it, do we?
It's fake, that's what it be to you, dig me? Yo, Terminator X, step up on the stand and show these people what time it is, boy. Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype.
Don't believe the hype, it's a sequel. As an equal, can I get this through to you? My 98 booming with a trunk of funk. All the jealous punks can't stop the dunk. Coming from the school of hard knocks, some perpetrate, they drink Clorox, attack the black, because I know they lack exact the cold facts, and still they try to Xerox. The leader of the new school, uncool, never played the fool, just made the rules. Remember there's a need to get alarm, again I said I was a time bomb. In the daytime, radio scared of me, cause I'm mad, plus I'm the enemy. They can't come on and play me in prime time, cause I know the time, plus I'm getting mine. I get on the mix late in the night. They know I'm living right, so here goes the mic sight. Before I let it go, don't rush my show. You try to reach and grab and get elbow. Word to her, yo, if you can't swing this, learn the words, you might sing this. Just a little bit of the taste of the bass for you. As you get up and dance at the LQ, with some deny it, defy it, I swing bolos. Then it clear the lane, I go solo. The meaning of all of that, the media is the whack. As you believe it's true, it blows me through the roof. Suckers, liars, give me a shovel. Some writers I know are damn devils. From them I say don't believe the hype.
Yo Chuck, they must be on the pipe, right?
Their pens and pads I snatch cause I've had it. I'm not an addict, fiend if for static. I see their tape recorder and I grab it.
No you can't have it back, silly rabbit.
I'm going to my media assassin, Harry Allen, I gotta ask him.
Yo Harry, you're a writer, are we that tight?
Don't believe the hype.
And all those things you know.
Yeah, boy, part two bum rush the show. Yo, Grip.
Get the green, black, and red in. Gold down, countdown, and Armageddon. 88, you wait, the S1s will. Put the left in effect, and I still will. Rock the hard jams, treat it like a seminar. Reach the bourgeois, and rock the boulevard. Some say I'm negative, but then I'm positive. What I got to give?
The media says this.
Red,
yo,
black,
don't
and green.
That hype. They got to be
you know what
that
I mean?
Hype. You know what I'm saying? You're the
Megan's got them going up to see Captain Kirk like a jerk and they out of work. Let me tell y'all a little something, man. A lot of people on daytime radio scared of us because they too ignorant to understand the lyrics of the truth that we pumping into them clouds, that brain cells, that they're spotting under them wooden skulls they call caps, you know what I'm saying? But the S1s are straightening it out quick, fast, in a hurry. Don't worry, flavor vision ain't blurry, you know what I'm saying?
In the early days, the True School Hip Hop Show was a big piss up at the BFM studios. I know for a fact that there's a lot of people in this building that were actually a little bit afraid of us, because I would roll up here with my record bag and like 15 dudes and like two dozen beers, and well, more than two dozen beers, and we would all get pissed. We would stand around in the lobby and just be monsters, you know, and we weren't trying to be aggressive, but we just by nature, we were pack hunters, you know. So that show was really exciting, you know. Like, I used to really look forward to it. It was like, yeah, I'm going to get up there, and all these rappers would come up and hang out, and then we'd rap on the mic. And then at some point, I think we just all collectively thought, well, this is such a cool thing. We started to own it, you know. It felt like our space, and we didn't. If you live in a space, you don't necessarily want to piss in it because it's going to start to smell. So we thought, let's start respecting what we're doing. And at the same time, Bass said, well, why don't we do a party, you know. True school parties. And that is kind of when the True School started to really pick up steam, because we were still clowning around for sure, absolutely. And we thought, wow, that's a really good idea. And then we did the first one, and it was huge. And it was at Luna on Simon Street. Oh, yeah. And that party was like, it was all Bass's idea. Me, Daryl, and I don't care what those guys say, we had no interest in doing it because we didn't want to carry the risk. We didn't honestly want to have anything to do with it except for DJ at it and have some drinks. So we did it, and it was massive. It was awesome. And then the station going, wow, that was really good. So then the Life to Air thing came about. So We started to do more of them, and we did them, we broadcast live to the station, and that was awesome. I mean, that was a really exciting time. Bands started to play, and that's when the Lost Drive popped up from UPR, and that's when I met Suntan and Brother D. And this is when it all started to sort of blossom into something a little bit more than just a whole bunch of guys trying to be American rappers, you know? Well, it's funny because people treat it like it's some kind of brand new invention now on other stations. We were doing that shit 20 years ago, and it's like, it was really cool then, and it's really cool now. But at the time, no one was really doing it. I remember actually, who was the PD back then? Was it Graham?
Yeah,
Graham.
Graham Hill.
Graham Hill, yeah. Well, I never liked him. And we banged heads pretty badly, actually. So on air, we were giving away some Ronnie Jordan tickets. He came on tour, the Mo Jazz guy. Me being, I openly admit I'm a dick. I was a dick back then. I was a really arrogant little shit. But I was in a position of power because me and Daryl were those DJs. So I was just a little bit unruly and a bit annoying. Anyway, we had this Ronnie Jordan giveaway on air, which was a ticket to his concert. And I got on air and I was like, yeah, well, give us a call now. Ring Corby FM and you can win a Ronnie Jordan ticket even though he sucks. That's so out of line. And I would never do that nowadays. And Graham must have heard and he's like, he comes up the station. And I gave a ticket away. He goes, oh, yeah, you want a ticket to see Ronnie Jordan? He's going to bore you shitless. You might go to sleep, but at least you'll hear some nice music or something. So, you know, from a radio station point of view, that is really out of line, degrading to the artist and all that kind of shit. And it's true. So anyway, I come out of the studio here, go into the lobby, and he's Graham. And he's like standing there and he's tapping his foot. And he comes right up to me. I got to give him credit because he's got balls. Because I had these guys called the Boogeymen from West Auckland here. A couple of them pretty big. And he stood there and he's like, you can't say that kind of shit on the radio. Blah. And he got right up in my face. I remember looking him in the face going, I'm going to fucking punch you right in the face. But just put it into perspective. He was the station manager. He's doing what he's supposed to do. But don't come up to some dude from Papakura full of beer.
When he's got two massive guys called the Boogeymen standing behind him.
And eight other guys in the lobby. That's why I got to give him credit, because he got on my face about it. But the thing was, there was a time and a place to do everything. He should have pulled me aside and taken me outside. He has no idea to this day that he dodged a bullet, man. We never spoke again after that. We started doing it together. Slave, DLT, and DJ Severe became the True School Hip Hop Show.
Every week.
And that's what happened. We morphed into this three-headed. Like, so me and Daryl used to take turns. But Daryl, being sort of the elder statesman, he used to just tell me when I was going to do it and when I wasn't going to do it. Daryl was really good at picking up on tunes real early as well. But he was also extremely opinionated. So if he hated something of mine, I was never going to play it again. But, you know, that's part of the game. I think it's pretty cool, actually. You know. And then in 97, yeah, well, now we've been doing it for a few years, P Money turned up. So, you know, I'm from Papakura. He's from Papakura. This little snot-nosed, gangly, long-haired white kid from Papakura turned up and fucking blew us away. You know, he was amazing. Because up until that point, all the best DJs came out of Wellington. Raw, Sean T, Goosh, all those guys. They were that was the power. When they arrived in the city, you know, we were about to get messed up because they're gonna kill us, you know? And that's what was happening. And then P Money turned up out of nowhere and was just so skilled and amazing. What he did was he said, if I come into the studio on Thursday nights, can I DJ? And we were like, maybe. So every Thursday night, he would catch a bus from Papakura, which takes about an hour to get into town, and he would come and hang out in the studio and sometimes not get to play not one song. And then get back on the bus and go all the way back to Papakura. He just did it the right way, you know. He paid his dues by hanging around us and not listening to us because we're full of shit. Sort of deciding what he liked, you know. And he carved his own niche. It was really cool. But that's what you do, yeah. Right? When you're a DJ at a club and you want to have a go, you can go there and say, can I DJ? And someone might just go, no. And then you go, okay, cool. And then you go away. And then sometimes they say yes. So in hindsight, he did it exactly the right way. You know, it wasn't that much longer after that I left B to go elsewhere, and then it became P Show, you know? We did the Max TV thing for a few years, and it was awesome. It was really good. When we first started that show, we had stuff like Group Home, you know, and Blase Blase, and all this really classic hip-hop stuff. That's why it cracks me up now when younger people, talk about the golden age of hip-hop, like, dude, you weren't even born then, you know? Me and DLT were playing that shit on the TV and on the radio. Your dad was scratching his balls. You weren't even anywhere near that yet. So I'm not being overly demonstrative about it. I'm just saying that was the golden age of hip-hop. And what we would do is we would go around all the record companies, get their VHS cassettes, and dub them to beta and broadcast them. It was ridiculous. Like, the quality of the pictures is awful, but we... You know, I would like to think that we broke Wu-Tang Clan in this country because we were playing that shit way before anyone else was playing it. And Kirk Harding had a massive part to do with that. Like, Kirk would request VHS copies of these things or betas. They would arrive straight on air. Like, we could put things on air within a day. And that was really important in the progression of this country's appreciation of a broader range of hip-hop. Ultimately, Daryl was the final word in the show. Like, I would go, you know, can we play an Ice Cube song? He's like, nah. We're playing this Chuck D video every single week for the next year. And we did. But then I managed to temper it down a little bit. So we got totally political with it when the elections came around. We got Tommy Eti on the show. And he was saying all kinds of really awesome shit. And we would get people on the show. When Rock Raider came here recently, passed, rest in peace, he came on the show. We did so much good stuff, man. What I hear nowadays is people go, I used to record that show. And I was sent to my cousin in Oakuni. I sent to my cousin, Masterton. And so it had this massive groundswell behind it. And it was all done on the skin of our teeth. We don't know what the hell we're doing. But somehow it was good enough for after a few years that we got approached by MTV to do something a bit different. People hated on us hard. Like when Daryl and I, we did True School TV, and it was like there was the BFM community and then there was the regular community. When me and DLT did the True School TV, you know, BFMers felt like they owned the show, and they did. But when we left, that's what happened, is everyone turned on us like that. There was heaps of haters, man. And once again, it was like a whole bunch of dudes in a room with a camera saying shit to us that they didn't realize that we could just come up there and punch them in the face. So, and I don't want to make this whole program all about punching people in the face. No, but, you know, there's a couple of people, they're so lucky, because me and Daryl were sitting there going, I'm going to fucking go up there in College Hill and I'm going to smack him in the head. Because he's just so misinformed.
These were BFM people?
They were BFM people. Of course they were. You know, there's a line and eventually we're going to crack and I'm just around the corner in Cromer Road. I'm just down the road. So I will come up there. And then I remember actually sending a text message on my really old school phone to someone up there saying, tell him to shut up. I'm going to come up there and kick him in the head. And then it stopped. So that's cool. But you know, and you know what? I'll tell you, well, what is this all about? This shows you how passionate people were about the True School brand. It's because people really thought they owned it, and they did, because they made it what it is. So it became this really interesting property that everyone wanted to have. They wanted to hold it. And it harks back to when I used to be my dad's DJ, and I used to play records because I was listening to them anyway. I was listening to rap music anyway. I was watching videos anyway. We just happened to be the ones there doing it.
That's right.
And it's funny now when I look back on it, because none of this stuff I sought. I didn't chase after any of this shit. I didn't chase after BFM to put me on air. They came after me. And I didn't chase down Max TV to come after me to do the TV show with Daryl. They came after us. Okay, so I wanted to play something completely different, actually. I wanted to play New Order song because my musical progression went through various stages. And I was unashamedly a massive Frankie Goes to Hollywood fan at some point in time. And that's Kerry Buchanan's fault. He put me onto that. I've never actually ever said this in any interview ever. But it was Kerry Buchanan's fault that I like Frankie Goes to Hollywood, because I saw him one day and he said, I'm going to go pre-order the Two Tribes 12-inch. You should come with me. And then he kind of gassed me up on this whole concept, and I bought into it, and then I wasted heaps of money on it. So when I was going through this pop and electronic phase, I also reconnected with a friend of mine called Barney, who was the editor of Pavement magazine. And through high school, we were massive New Order fans. Like really, really massive. We ran our own magazine that we distributed by hand, and we used to frequent all the record stores and buy basically everything. So I wanted to play Perfect Kiss by New Order, because that song for me, out of all their catalogue, is the one song I kind of think is perfect. There's just beautiful progression, and the drums sound amazing, the keyboards, and the vocals are just great. So this is one song that I could totally pull out of my, one of your favourite songs of all time. And I also discovered it through B, because B were the ones that championed New Order. It certainly wasn't any of the other stations. So yeah, New Order, Perfect Kiss.
I still have the side by myself, kicking high.
It was about 99 that I finished at the station, but it wasn't to be my last foray. I went to MyFM because radio is my passion, no doubt about it. It's the one thing that I think has been greatly misused and underutilized from an educational point of view. I understand that in my life, in me, there is a whole bunch of contradictions. There's no doubt about that. Like, I play the most trashiest club music, pop music to kids in Gold Coast clubs that would make you, you know, would make you want to punch me in the head. And I understand that, but this is who I am. I know exactly who I am. I don't have any qualms about my own personal identity, but I walk a really fine line. But I knew that I had a whole bunch of music that I was really passionate about, and I didn't feel like being on B was, I wasn't getting through to enough people. And so I went to MyFM. I started getting through to a whole lot of fucking people. I had a massive effect, and it was really cool. And I loved it, you know. It became part of me, you know, and I created this late night hype persona. And then what happened was, you know, I kind of had a personal falling out with a couple of people up there. And then I thought, I'm going to go back to the true school. Just like that. I'm going back to the true school. So I left. And that was about 2002. And the reason I know this is because Scribe rapped about it. On the Crusader. So on the Crusader, I can't remember the song off the top of my head. There's a song on there. I went back to the true school like DJ Severe. So that's when it happened. It was 2002, 2003. I came back and I joined up with Money again. And by now, Money was gathering momentum. So I was kind of good that I came back because he needed to take some time off. And I did too. I was away touring. So between the two of us, we managed to create the show and back into what it could be is a bit more expansive.
Yeah.
However, the funny thing was is that by then, me and Money had been traveling on different journeys. We loved the same music. So we would get on the show and we would be trumping each other all the time. Like, I was about to play that, you dick. You know, so it was really funny. I did it for another 2 years with P-Money. I really, really enjoyed it. And then we started to blood Mulligan as our new DJ. He is a fucking awesome DJ. That kid has got skills for days. He doesn't have the passion that you need to elevate himself to the next level, but you don't have to. You can be whoever you want as a DJ. You don't have to aspire to be the best. But he's just very passive and quite very nice. The show is his now. Penfold is taking that form of it, but it's Morley's show, you know?
Yeah.
I am the editor of Rip It Up now. It's not my magazine yet. I feel like I've got, maybe takes 4 or 5 years and then everyone goes, that's Phil's Rip It Up, you know? Murray's example was a huge one to live up to. So the true school as an identity, it needs to be respected. And you have to gain that respect to be that person. You have to do your time. It's like you don't just do it for a year and you go, that's my radio show. Maybe you're the only person on it. You still don't own it until you've done a bit more time, you know what I mean? So anyway, what happened was I did it. I came back for about another year or so, and then my career exploded. So I got a contract in Australia, and I just couldn't do it anymore. So I went away from radio altogether for about 6 months, and then I realized that deep down inside me, that's what I love doing. I just love doing radio. It just, you know, I'll play you 5 hits. I'm going to play you 4 songs you never heard before, and you better can listen to them because I'm going to ram it down your throat for a whole month. That's me. That's what I like to do. And, you know, DJ Premier taught me all of this shit. And I know it sounds really contrived to say DJ Premier taught me this, but he did. He sat me down in his Manhattan studio, and he shoved it down my throat. And the words that he told me that day ring in my ears. Really, really looking loudly today, where he's like, if you're going to be submissive and be a radio DJ that everyone tells you to be, then fine, do that. But you're not a fucking DJ. I actually remember arguing with him and then realizing I should just shut up. And then I just started to learn the lesson, and it's really important, you know? And so I went back to Mike because I knew that whatever I did, whatever I'm going to do from now on, it's got to be important. It's got to be big. It's got to be important. It's got to be long-reaching. So I went back to Mike, and that's where I am today. And now I own that spot. Forever, I'll have Prem ringing in my ears, you know? I mean, I'll play like 2 Lil Wayne songs, then I'll play a Royce 5'9", Black Poet, you know, Black Milk song, you name it. That's our job. You know, it's not to be submissive. I think BFM is just iconic, you know? And it's way more iconic than other mainstream rock stations because other mainstream stations are so they're so lifeless. They follow trends and they follow what the Americans do, whereas B just doesn't, you know? And I love the fact that some acts that we see today that have become massive are fully championed and 100% backed by the B-Nets, not commercial radio. I don't know, Shapeshifter? You know, I don't see anybody playing Shapeshifter at all.
Concord Dawn.
Concord Dawn, nobody was playing that. I mean, Morning Light, no one was playing that song. And then I remember when The Edge played it, I was like, what the f-? That was a BFM thing. That wasn't necessarily B-Net. That was the B-Nets afterwards. It was a BFM thing. And I just think that you need that. And in some ways, as really defeatist as this sounds, I don't think it has to change that much. Because this is what whatever raggedy-ass things that you do, or whatever free volunteer things that you do, or whatever, you know, kind of indie feeling things you do, that is what makes the station. So, you know, do we want to move forward in the you know, in the computer era or the internet era? You know, of course you want to broadcast live to the net, but do you want to change it? I don't know. I don't think it would feel the same if I came up here and there wasn't four rows of vinyl of that old, with that old ugly ass red tape down the side of it. I think it would feel weird if it wasn't, you know. And I think that that is what makes it unique. And I don't know. I don't think I want it to change. But I know that's a bad thing. I feel like that's a bad thing to say because that's you get complacent. But shit, man, there's so many new people coming through here, and they're young and they're eager. They're not necessarily influenced by what people did here 40 years ago. In fact, they're not, you know. And I think it's awesome that it's got the same computer code on the door that it was 10 years ago. I just, you know, it's these things that make it unique.
DJ Servia, thank you so much for your time and reminiscing about the True School.
Kia ora, it's been mean. I'm going to choose a track by a band called Main Source, and this group includes a rapper called Large Professor, who's possibly one of the greatest hip-hop producers and rhymers of all time. He's like Jewel. He can rap and he can produce. And this song was really pivotal in the history of True School Hip-Hop Show on BFM. And listening to the song, this is totally one of my top 20 songs of all time. And it has just lots of meaning at this station. It's called Looking at the Front Door. And it's kind of like it's like a love song, an anti-love song, kind of lots of attitude. It's from this so-called golden era of hip-hop, and it is absolute perfection. It feels like the right song to go out on.
And wake up to be greeted by an argument again. You act like a 10, so immature. I try to concentrate on the cure and keep looking at the front door. Thinking if I were to evacuate, you'd probably be straighter than straight and wouldn't have so much hate. Cause you don't know the pain I feel when I see you smiling. And when I roll up, you start wilding. So I front like everything's hunky-dory. But it's a whole different story. You don't like the fact that I'm me. I don't put on a show when it comes time for you to have company. And your friends don't understand your choice of man. They speak proper while my speech is from a garbage can. But regardless, you shouldn't have to be so raw. I'm looking at the front door. I'm looking at the front door. Baby, I'm looking at the front door. I'm looking at the front door. And when you're with your friends, I glide to the side until the spotlight is mine. And never sabotage a good time. But when they're not around, the fights commence. I'm the one you're against, and it doesn't make sense. Cause I'm the one that you claim to love for life. But all I get is gray hairs and strife. And I can play some old stuck up rapper role. And get foul every time you lose control. But that's not my order of operations. So I should win an award for lots of patience. Cause that's all a fella can have with a girl who's shooting up his world like Shav. And I don't think that I can take it anymore. I'm looking at the front door. 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 Always tell me how I'm lucky to possess the best looking girl in the whole US. But every time
extreme, you blow your finesse. Trying to test the professor. 24 hours of acting sore. Sometimes I wish you'd come down with lockjaw, so I don't have to take in the breaking. You treat me like a burnt piece of bacon. It seems like just 2 years back when we were bonded and not pierced. But now I keep itching to jet, sitting in a chair just to stare, set to sprint. Yo, sweetheart, you better take a hint. I say it now like I said it before. I'm looking at the front door. I'm looking at the front door. I'm looking at the front door. I'm looking at the front door.
You have been listening to the BFM Historical Society, a radio documentary series made to commemorate BFM's 40th anniversary. The Historical Society is broadcast every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. and is available as a podcast from BFM's website later on in the week. The BFM Historical Society is produced at BFM by Dubhead.